In episode 4, we ended at the wall, the gigawatt campus, the liquid-cooled rack, and the realization that electricity, not silicon, now paces the build-out. This episode, we step off the physical layer entirely and ask where the money actually pools. And I'll open with the deepest moat in the business, which is not NVIDIA's transistors, but its software. The framing to hold in an interview is platform versus platform, not chip versus chip. CUDA, Compute Unified Device Architecture, is the layer that turns a die into something a developer programs. And the durable lock-in is the library stack writing on top. cuDNN for the neural network primitives, cuBLOS for linear algebra, TensorRT for inference, and NCCL, the collective communications library that lets thousands of GPUs exchange gradients without stalling. NVIDIA shipped CUDA in 2006, 2 decades before anyone knew deep learning would matter. And that patient bet compounded into an ecosystem variously estimated near 4 million developers. Treat that as a vendor figure. With PyTorch, JAX, and TensorFlow, all first-class citizens, tuned to run best there. The practical result is a win rate on frontier training runs that rounds to 100%. Every frontier model you have heard of was trained on NVIDIA. The lock is real because a rival can match raw performance and still lose. Switching means rewriting and retuning an enormous body of hand-optimized kernels, and the asynchronous, custom-tuned ones are the hardest to port. Now, where the moat is widest, the siege is heaviest, and the honest read is that the cracks are real but slow. The point an interviewer wants is that the genuine threat is not a rival GPU. It is the abstraction layer above the chip and the hyperscaler ASIC below it, which my co-lecturer will take in turn. Hold that distinction. NVIDIA's enemy is not AMD's next part. It is the software that makes the part underneath it interchangeable.
I'll take the cracks themselves and the value capture map, because that is where the strategy gets concrete. The open challenger is AMD's ROCM, the Radeon Open Compute Stack, and the fair verdict is that it has earned real traction in inference and at smaller shops, but still trails badly in frontier training, because porting complex CUDA kernels remains genuinely hard. The cleverer attacks are indirect. OpenAI's Triton is a Python-level kernel language aiming to be hardware-agnostic. Write once, retarget. PyTorch's version 2 compilers increasingly act as a leveling layer that demotes the chip underneath to a backend. And the compiler infrastructures, MLIR and XLA, accelerated linear algebra, the compiler Google uses to target its own silicon, abstract the hardware further still. Each erodes lock-in for specific workloads, but none has dissolved it. The deeper threat is the in-house ASIC, application-specific integrated circuit, because it sidesteps CUDA entirely with its own stack. Google's TPU on XLA and JAX, AWS Trainium on Neuron. That is why this matters for value capture. Walk the chain and the gross margin pools at two nodes. NVIDIA's overall gross margin sits near 75%. Its first quarter results this year showed about 75, with data center revenue around $75 billion in a single quarter. And analysts put the Blackwell-class parts even higher. TSMC, which actually fabricates those dies, runs a gross margin in the mid-60s now. Its first quarter this year printed around 66%, and it lifted its through-cycle target above 56. The equipment tier below, ASML, holds low to mid-50s, so the design and platform layer captures the most, the foundry captures the next slab, and the further down the equipment and materials chain you go, the thinner it gets, which is precisely the logic driving everyone to integrate toward the fat end.
I'll take why the hyperscalers build their own chips, because it follows directly from that margin map. The motive is the NVIDIA tax. When roughly 3/4 of a GPU's price is the seller's gross margin, and you are buying tens of billions a year, every dollar you keep by designing in-house is enormous. That is the whole logic of custom silicon. Google's TPU is the most mature example, now many generations deep, with Anthropic as a major training customer, the clearest proof a frontier lab can train at scale off NVIDIA. Amazon runs Trainium for training and Inferentia for inference. Microsoft has Maya, Meta has MTIA. The tension you should be able to articulate is that these firms are simultaneously NVIDIA's largest customers and its emerging rivals, buying tens of billions in GPUs while spending billions to escape needing them, unable to cut the cord because CUDA and NVIDIA's annual cadence still own training. And the silent enablers are Broadcom and Marvell, which do not sell a finished accelerator brand. They co-design the custom chips. Broadcom is the lead partner behind Google's TPU and OpenAI's accelerator program. So when someone says custom silicon is coming for NVIDIA, what they often mean concretely is that Broadcom is building the alternatives. Now, the second order point, the one that separates a sharp answer from a glib one, even when a hyperscaler designs its own ASIC, it still buys the package from TSMC, the high bandwidth memory from SK Hynix, and the networking switch silicon from Broadcom. The custom chip escapes the NVIDIA tax, but not the TSMC tax, not the HBM tax, not the packaging bottleneck. Vertical integration relocates which monopoly you pay. It does not free you from the chain. That is why the in-house ASIC dents NVIDIA's share without breaking the underlying choke points my co-lecturer mapped.
I'll take cloud versus neo-cloud economics, because the financing structure here is where the bubble argument actually lives. The hyperscalers, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Meta, are guiding combined 2026 capital expenditure somewhere in the $600 to $700 billion range, up sharply from last year, the overwhelming majority tied to AI infrastructure. And they fund it from their own cash flows, plus, increasingly, bond issuance. Roughly $100 billion in fresh debt early this year, with credit default swap protection bid up, an early bubble watch signal. Alongside them sits a newer, more fragile layer, the neo-clouds, the GPU specialist clouds. CoreWeave is the bellwether. First quarter revenue this year, roughly $2 billion, more than double year-on-year. A reported backlog near $100 billion, and still a gap net loss around $740 million, because the model is intensely capital-intensive and debt-fueled, even as adjusted earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization run a healthy margin. Behind it, Lambda, Crusoe, and Nebius play the same game. The mechanism to understand is GPU as collateral financing. A neocloud borrows against the GPUs it owns and against the long-term take-or-pay contracts a lab has signed, then uses the loan to buy more GPUs. That works only if the chips hold residual value and the contracts hold up, and GPUs depreciate fast.
I'll take training versus inference economics, because the two halves of the business behave nothing alike, and the balance is tipping. Training is a bursty capital bet. You assemble an enormous cluster, burn electricity and chip time for weeks to produce one model, and the run ends. It is lumpy, front-loaded, a wager that the result earns its keep. Inference is the opposite, a continuous 24-hour cost incurred on every query for as long as the product lives, which makes it brutally margin sensitive, because a fraction of a cent per token is paid out billions of times. The defining trend of this cycle is the shift toward inference. It was roughly half of all AI compute last year and is projected near two-thirds this year. And several executives describe a long-run flip from 80% training toward 80% inference. Inference infrastructure spend reportedly jumped from around $9 billion last year to roughly $20 this year, driven by enterprises moving from pilots to always-on agentic workloads that run and take actions continuously. Here is the paradox to internalize. The price of a unit of intelligence, cost per token, fell on the order of 80% year over year, yet total inference spend exploded anyway. That is a Jevons paradox effect. Make a thing cheaper and you consume so much more that aggregate spend rises. Cheaper inference grows the market rather than shrinking it, which is the rebuttal to anyone who reads falling token prices as a collapsing business. Competitively, this is the opening for everyone who is not NVIDIA, because the moat is strongest in frontier training and weakest in inference, where ROCM has its best traction, where Inferentia and the inference-tuned startups compete, and where total cost of ownership reasoning, counting power and cooling and networking over years, can beat ecosystem lock-in. The more the world tilts to inference, the wider that door swings. The through line into the model lab economics my co-lecturer takes next.
I'll take the model labs, the demand engine. And the headline here is a reordering you must narrate carefully. These labs do not merely buy compute, they pull it into existence, signing multi-year, multi-gigawatt, hundreds of billions dollar commitments that underwrite the entire build-out. So when OpenAI signs, the signal ripples down to TSMC and SK Hynix. The numbers, flagged as announced commitments rather than booked revenue, OpenAI has a partnership to deploy at least 10 gigawatts of NVIDIA systems, with NVIDIA investing up to $100 billion. A 6-gigawatt AMD deal worth perhaps $90 billion that even bundles warrants on AMD stock. A roughly 10-gigawatt Broadcom custom accelerator program cited near $350 billion. The Oracle and Stargate arrangement on the order of $300 billion. And an Amazon deal near $38 billion, much of it contingent. Against that stands the operating reality. OpenAI's first quarter revenue this year was reported near $5.7 billion, a roughly 30-plus billion annualized run rate. Yet it is still burning heavily, with full-year losses reported around $14 billion and 8-year commitments cited near $1.4 trillion. The striking twist is Anthropic, which by reports overtook OpenAI on run rate revenue this spring, climbing past $30 billion annualized and reportedly toward $45 billion, while spending markedly less on training. And it runs heavily on Google's TPUs through an
I'll take geopolitics, the strategic narrative an interviewer most wants you to articulate, starting with the export control logic and its zigzags. Washington decided the most advanced AI compute is a national security asset, like a weapons technology, and set out to slow China's access to the leading edge. So through the Bureau of Industry and Security, BIS, the export regulator inside commerce, the controls restrict the most capable accelerators, the EUV machines, and increasingly HBM and the leading-edge tools. The thresholds are written as performance and performance density limits, which is why vendors design compliant parts that sit just under the line, a moving cat-and-mouse game. The H20 saga captures the volatility. NVIDIA built the H20 as a throttled China-specific chip. Exports were halted in spring of 2025, reinstated that summer, reportedly tied to an unusual revenue share with the government. And then in January of 2026, Commerce moved the more capable H200 and AMD's MI325X from presumption of denial to case-by-case licensing, conditioned on supply assurances, security reviews, and third-party performance testing, paired, by report, with a tariff on those China-bound parts. As of mid-2026, the picture is that roughly 10 Chinese firms, Alibaba, Tencent, ByteDance among them, were cleared to buy H200s under a per-customer cap near 75,000 units, yet deliveries remain stalled in legal and policy limbo. The headline to carry? The rules change constantly, so always say as of the latest round rather than stating it as fixed. The second-order effects matter more than the letter of any rule. Controls bite in the near term, but they guarantee China pours resources into catching up, and gray markets route restricted parts through third countries wherever scarcity meets demand. So the lever is real, but blunt and leaky, and its consequences compound for years rather than resolving cleanly. The bridge to China's domestic answer, which my co-lecturer takes.
I'll take China's response and the Taiwan concentration that frames everything. The controls accelerated a homegrown stack. Huawei's Ascend accelerators paired with SMIC, China's leading foundry, building good enough silicon. The scale is real. Huawei is reported to be roughly doubling Ascend output this year, on the order of 600,000 of its 910C class, and up to perhaps 1.5 million dies across the line, with the newer 950 already sampling on SMIC's advanced process. But recall the constraint from episode 2. SMIC is walled off from ASML's EUV, so it pushes advanced nodes on deep ultraviolet immersion with heavy multi-patterning, technically possible, but low yield and expensive. And the binding limit now is memory. China's domestic HBM, principally from CXMT, is reported sufficient for only a few hundred thousand Ascend equivalent packages this year, so the HBM choke point the controls target throttles the whole effort. The analytical consensus, including from the Council on Foreign Relations, is that Huawei still meaningfully lags NVIDIA, and the controls do bite, even as they strengthen a long-run competitor. Now the geographic overlay, which is the heart of the strategic answer. Stack the monopolies, and they are also a map. Leading-edge fabrication and CoWoS packaging in Taiwan, EUV in the Netherlands, advanced memory in Korea, accelerators plus CUDA in the United States. Taiwan's centrality is the so-called silicon shield, the notion that being indispensable is itself protection, because the whole world needs it stable, and cross-strait tension is, by a wide margin, the sector's largest tail risk.
A single disruption at one node, one fab, one fire, one blockade, cascades up through every layer above it, because no one else can fabricate leading-edge dies or assemble the packages at volume. That concentration is exactly what the reshoring push is trying to unwind, which closes the strategic loop.
I'll close the geopolitics with reshoring and the CHIPS Act, because it is where policy meets the limits of money. The 2022 CHIPS and Science Act ceded roughly $50 billion of incentives to pull fabrication back onshore, and the marquee result is TSMC's Arizona build, 4-nanometer production already running, a total commitment now reported around $165 billion across multiple fabs, packaging plants, and research, with 2-nanometer and A16 planned for U.S. soil. Intel, leaning on 18A and government support, and Samsung in Texas round out the domestic leading-edge bet. And in January of 2026, a U.S.-Taiwan trade arrangement layered on hundreds of billions more in direct investment and credit guarantees, with a stated goal of bringing something like 40% of Taiwan's chip supply chain onshore. Here is the caveat that makes the sophisticated answer. Reshoring the wafer fab does not de-risk the chain, because the advanced packaging and the HBM still sit overwhelmingly in Asia. You can pour concrete in Arizona and still have the CoWoS interposer step and the memory stacks an ocean away, on the wrong side of the same strait. And the leading-edge yield advantage TSMC built in Taiwan from Episode 2's learning curve flywheel does not teleport with the buildings. So the realistic verdict, an interviewer rewards, reshoring narrows the single point of failure risk over a 5 to 10 year horizon at significantly higher cost, but it does not eliminate it this decade, because cost, yield, and the packaging and memory tail all still concentrate abroad. The strategic shape of the whole industry, then, is an overlay of monopoly and geography that no amount of capital reshuffles quickly, which is precisely why export controls target the narrowest nodes, why Taiwan is called a shield, and why the bubble versus boom debate and the supply chain fragility debate are really the same debate viewed from two ends.
I'll take vertical integration as the unifying lens, because every move we have described is the same move in different directions. Think of it as a land grab, where each layer you own is a layer whose margin you keep. NVIDIA started as a chip company and integrated upward into full rack-scale systems, outward into networking by acquiring Mellanox, into software with CUDA, and now into equity stakes in its own customers, like OpenAI, a striking inversion where the supplier capitalizes the demand. The hyperscalers integrate downward into silicon with their custom ASICs, and further down into power generation with nuclear and on-site gas deals. The labs integrate into chips and data centers. OpenAI's Broadcom program is a lab designing its own accelerator, and Stargate is a lab entering the data center business. Even the foundry integrates as TSMC pushes up into advanced packaging it once left to others. The end state to name in an interview is that the industry is consolidating into a handful of vertically integrated stacks rather than a clean horizontal market where each layer is a separate competitive business. And that consolidation is both a margin strategy and a hedge against the very choke points we mapped. Now the 60-second synthesis you should be able to deliver cold. AI capability is bottlenecked by compute, and compute runs through a narrow, deep chain of near monopolies: TSMC in fabrication, ASML in lithography, SK Hynix in memory, NVIDIA plus CUDA in accelerators and software. The binding constraint shifted from designing the chip toward packaging, HBM, and power. Demand is pulled by maybe 5 labs signing hundreds of billions in multi-year, partly circular commitments, which makes the bubble question legitimate. The biggest structural trend is training giving way to inference, which is also where the moat is most contestable. And the whole thing rests on a geopolitical fault line. Taiwan concentration and U.S.-China export controls, that is the largest tail risk in the sector. Say that fluently and defend any piece of it, and you sound like someone who understands the industry, rather than its headlines.
Let me compress the durable map before we hand to the perishable one. NVIDIA's moat is software, not silicon. And the real threat is not a rival GPU, but the abstraction layer above and the hyperscaler ASIC below. The gross margin pools at the design and platform layer and the foundry, which is why everyone integrates toward the fat end. The hyperscalers build chips to escape the NVIDIA tax while remaining its biggest customers, and discover the custom part still pays the TSMC tax and the HBM tax.
The NeoClouds finance GPUs as melting collateral against take-or-pay contracts, and the vendor financing loop makes the bubble question fair without making it settled. Training is a bursty bet, and inference a continuous, margin-sensitive cost. And the decisive shift to inference is exactly where the competitive door opens. The labs pull demand into existence, and the surprise of this year is that the revenue leader, Anthropic, is the lab least bound to NVIDIA. And under all of it sits an overlay of monopoly and geography that export controls, China's constrained domestic push, and a costly reshoring drive can only slowly, partially unwind. There is one mental discipline I want to leave you with, because it is what an interviewer is really testing. Almost every number in this episode, margins, revenue, CapEx, the megadeal totals, the export control status, has a half-life measured in a quarter or two, and several of the biggest are announced rather than booked. So the expert habit is to hold the structure firmly and the figures loosely. Be certain about who sits at which choke point and why the value pools where it does, and be explicitly provisional about the magnitudes, flagging estimates as estimates and announced commitments as announcements. That is the strategic layer, the part that changes in years, not weeks.
To close, I'll hand forward to the part that changes in weeks. Everything my co-lecturer just compressed is the durable skeleton, the choke points, the margin map, the integration logic, the geopolitical fault line. And that skeleton will look much the same a year from now. What will not look the same is the flesh on it. By the time you sit across from an interviewer, there will be a newer NVIDIA part shipping and a fresher roadmap beyond Rubin. AMD will have launched its next Instinct generation, and you will want the current data center revenue figure, not last quarter's. The HBM4 ramp and the CoWoS capacity numbers will have moved. The hyperscaler CapEx guidance will have been revised, probably upward. OpenAI and Anthropic will have posted new run rates and new losses, and the revenue lead between them may have changed hands again. And the export control regime, the single most volatile variable in this whole story, may have flipped the China licensing posture once or twice more. None of that overturns the strategic map. All of it is exactly what a sharp candidate refreshes the morning before the interview, so that the structural understanding you built across these five episodes is wrapped in current, defensible specifics rather than stale ones. That is the division of labor between the durable and the perishable, and it is the right note to end the strategic arc on. So in episode 6, the final one, we do precisely that refresh. The newest chips and the freshest roadmaps, the latest export control round, the live CapEx and burn numbers, the frontier debates, scaling limits, the inference time compute axis, the bubble argument at full volume, and a short, honest list of the open questions nobody in the industry has answered yet. It is the snapshot to take with you on the day you walk in.